The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Unraveling the Complex Choices in Early Breast Cancer, a Roadmap to Informed Multidisciplinary Decisions About Assessment and Treatment. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/YGX860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Thank you for joining us. This evening, we're here to talk about Unraveling the Complex Choices in Early Breast Cancer, a Roadmap to Informed Multidisciplinary Decisions About Assessment and Treatment. I'll be moderating our session this evening. I'm Laura Dominici. I'm a breast surgeon from Dana-Farber Brigham Cancer Center.
I'm Alex Steele. The slides might say Albert, but that's my dad's name, so they'll call me Alex. And I am a community surgeon here in Atlanta with Atlanta Breast Care.
And my name is Jane Mizell. I'm actually a breast medical oncologist, so not a surgeon, but a medical oncologist here in Atlanta and see a lot of breast cancer patients at Emory.
So our goals for today, we're here to augment the knowledge of the latest advances in systemic therapy for different subtypes of early stage breast cancer, obviously triple negative, hormone receptor positive, and HER2 positive. We hope to equip you with the skills to develop individualized multimodal treatment plans for patients with early breast cancer, and to enhance your ability to provide and implement multidisciplinary best practices to improve outcomes with early breast cancer. So we'll start off with early stage triple negative breast cancer.
Okay, our first case. This is a 38-year-old female patient who presents to the office with a palpable right breast mass. She's otherwise healthy, but she has a family history of breast cancer in her paternal grandmother in her 40s, as well as a paternal aunt with ovarian cancer. Ultrasound demonstrates a 2.3-centimeter hypoechoic mass in the area of palpable concern, as well as an enlarged axillary lymph node with thickened cortex in the right axilla. Biopsy of the mass and the lymph node both demonstrate grade 3 IDC, ER0, PR0, HER2-0, with clips placed at both sites.
Well, we'll launch right in. It seems like a lot of you may know some of this data already, but I think it's always good to review the trials and think about exactly how your patients may apply to that data or the other way around. So KEYNOTE-522 is a study that has really revolutionized how we treat early stage triple negative breast cancer. This is a trial that took patients with newly diagnosed triple negative breast cancer. They could be either greater than 2 centimeters and node negative or T1C and node positive. They could have been PD-L1 positive or PD-L1 negative. And patients were then randomized to receive chemotherapy plus placebo versus chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. And the chemo backbone that they received preoperative was a little bit more advanced than the traditional ACT that was typically used before this. Patients received carboplatin either weekly or every 3 weeks, along with paclitaxel and either pembrolizumab plus placebo for 12 weeks, then followed by anthracycline-based chemotherapy along with pembrolizumab for 12 weeks. So a 24-week preoperative regimen. Then patients went to surgery within 3 to 6 weeks of finishing their chemo. And then the patients who received pembrolizumab pre-op also received pembrolizumab post-op. The patients who received placebo pre-op also received placebo post-op. PCR and event-free survival were co-primary endpoints, and there were a number of secondary endpoints, including looking at these things in PD-L1 positive versus PD-L1 negative patients. So this is the primary endpoint of PCR. Very interesting outcomes, and you can see here that the patients who received pembrolizumab had a 14% improvement in PCR rates, going from about 50%, which is what we typically quoted patients with dose-dense ACT before this trial, to 65% getting to PCR, which is pretty impressive. And then PD-L1 status was an interesting thing to look at because a lot of our metastatic studies have shown that PD-L1 positive patients tend to be the ones that mostly benefit from pembrolizumab along with chemotherapy. But that was not the case here. You can see that patients who are PD-L1 positive tend to do better than those who are PD-L1 negative regardless, but that the pembrolizumab improved outcomes by about the same amount for each subgroup. So about a 15%, 14% benefit to receiving pembro along with chemo, regardless of your PD-L1 status in the early stage setting. And then if you look at event-free survival, I think that's always a good question and an important question. Does improvement in PCR rate translate to event-free survival improvements? And you can see here that at 36 months, there was a 7.7% overall improvement for those who received the pembrolizumab. And for triple-negative breast cancer, which does tend to often recur within that first 3 years, this is a very clinically relevant time point. So this was, kind of solidified this as a standard of care new regimen for patients with early stage triple negative disease. And this is interesting too. So looking at how people did, whether they got a PCR or whether they didn't get to PCR, you can see that if you got chemotherapy with placebo or chemotherapy with pembrolizumab and you got to PCR, didn't really matter how you get there. If at 36 months, you're likely to be doing pretty well in terms of your event-free survival if you got a PCR with either of these arms of the study. But if you didn't get to PCR, that higher risk subtype, you can see that the curves really separate pretty clearly by 36 months in terms of event-free survival. So if you don't get to PCR, but you received pembrolizumab pre-op, and on this study received pembrolizumab post-op, you have about a 67% chance of still remaining event-free or disease-free at 36 months. Whereas if you did not get to PCR and you did not receive pembrolizumab, that chance is about 56.8%, so a little over half, which sort of leads us to think that the pembrolizumab really does matter whether you get to PCR or not. And then if you look at nodal status, it's always that question too of like who benefits from this the most, because of course everything we give adds cost and potentially can add side effects. And you can see that patients who are node negative benefited less across the board than those patients who are node positive, but the node negative patients did still tend to benefit. So you see a 20.6% benefit in PCR, improvement in PCR rates in those patients who are node positive, making this really kind of a slam dunk for those patients who meet that criteria. But the node negative patients benefited too. And if you're a young patient with, 2-3 centimeter mass and you are given this opportunity, a lot of patients are willing to take on a little bit more risk for that 6.3% benefit as well. And if you can see with event-free survival, if you look at that plot to the right, regardless of whether you're node positive or node negative, you've got a very nice hazard ratio there, very good benefit in terms of improving your event-free survival. But what about side effects? So cost is obviously an issue, but side effects from treatment can also be a thing. And patients often ask us, as they should, what is this pembrolizumab or Keytruda going to add to our toxicity? And the good news is that a lot of these toxicities are very mild. Many patients actually don't have any additional side effects, but when they do, the most common ones tend to be rash, diarrhea, and endocrine side effects, mostly hypothyroidism. So we actually check a TSH with every cycle of pembrolizumab that we give. We counsel patients pretty distinctly in the beginning about the possibility of things like rash and diarrhea. Then, of course, we're checking liver function tests with every cycle, too, so we're likely to catch those problems. And then patients are seeing us fairly often on treatment, usually every 3 weeks. So hopefully we would catch any evidence of pneumonitis that came up. But what you can see here is that some of these side effects can happen even months later. And so you do need to be careful and make sure that patients who present with anything that's a little bit off or a little bit different, that you're considering whether this could be either a common or a more rare side effect of an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And this is looking at patients on the trial. What adverse events did they experience? And did that differ whether they were on the pembrolizumab arm versus the chemotherapy alone arm? You can see that the ones that were more common in the pembro arm were mainly infusion reactions and hypothyroidism. And if you look at side effects or adverse events that were grade 3 to 5, the more serious adverse events, it was actually skin reactions that were the ones that were the most bothersome and problematic. So those are things that, we now that we know this, we can tell patients to watch out for. We can give topical steroids. We can do a lot to prevent this from becoming bad. A lot of times what happens in the trial really teaches us what we should do with our patients in the general population. Fortunately, a lot of these more rare but serious side effects, pneumonitis, hepatitis, are things that happen less frequently and often are things that can be reversible with steroids and sometimes with stopping the pembrolizumab. So given all this, pembrolizumab did receive FDA approval for triple-negative breast cancer in July of 2021. So we've now been using this for almost 3 years in our high-risk early-stage patients. And then it's continued as it was in the trial as a single agent for adjuvant therapy after surgery.
So maybe we'll pause for a little discussion up on the podium here. I know you mentioned, Jane, that there are these endocrine side effects. Can you talk a little bit about, for the surgeons, things they may need to think about related to these side effects as you're planning surgery for a patient who's received this neoadjuvant regimen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, generally we are checking TSH pretty frequently. We also, look for adrenal insufficiency as well. So I think that would be one of the main things that might impact surgical outcomes and especially more emergently outcomes on the table. So you want to make sure that the medical oncologists you're working with are monitoring those things. And if they're not, then you probably want to be checking those pre-op. Rarely we see sometimes like autoimmune related anemias and thrombocytopenias and things like that. So obviously getting a CBC and making sure something like that is not going on is important. But otherwise, I think there's not a whole lot that's, from my standpoint, a lot different here.
And I think oftentimes people are checking a cortisol level. Is that what you'd recommend?
Yes. And we do. Okay. We actually do that at our institution with each cycle, the TSH and the cortisol. Okay. I think if there's any question about it, it could also be checked an additional time prior to surgery.
Got it. And it sounds like it maybe doesn't matter when you check it, since the side effects can be so variable. It's not like you'd need to check it right before the surgery versus at the end of the last.
Yeah.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And I know on that slide, there was about 11% or close to 11% of people who had toxicity that led to discontinuation of treatment. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a far superior regimen to what we had before. What about these people that do need to discontinue? Or what about someone who is maybe not well enough to start that regimen in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the challenges is it is a pretty intense regimen. And even some of the strongest patients have a really hard time getting through 24 weeks of, you know, four chemotherapy drugs plus pembrolizumab. So we often will talk about alternatives. You know, I think in young, healthy patients, we tend to start with this and then pull back if we need to. I find that doing the carboplatin weekly as opposed to every 3 weeks is actually much more beneficial in terms of cytopenias and nausea and stuff like that in the first 12 weeks. But then there are alternative regimens as well. So there was another study called NeoPact that was done and published about a year after this one, but looking at a simpler regimen. So it was just pembrolizumab, docetaxel, and carboplatin every 3 weeks for 6 treatments prior to surgery. And those patients had phenomenal PCR rates and also event-free survival when that study was followed out further. It was a much smaller trial and it was a single-arm trial, so it hasn't become a standard of care regimen, you know, default the way this has. But it's definitely a regimen I've used in patients who can't receive anthracyclines for cardiac-related reasons, who might be worried about more intense neuropathy for any reason, because docetaxel tends to cause less neuropathy than paclitaxel, which is what's used in this regimen. So that's a great option. And then actually, interestingly, the study that led to the KEYNOTE-522 trial being done in the first place was a study looking at just Taxol and pembrolizumab for 12 weeks, followed by AC alone, and then surgery. And that showed improved PCR rates as well. So I think, you know, there's no question that pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy gives superior outcomes, but there are a lot of different ways you can do that. And then there are some patients, I mean, I actually had one patient myself who was hospitalized for significant and severe hepatitis related to the pembrolizumab. And at that point in her regimen, we just said, sorry, like, we're not going to give you any more of that, and we're going to be all done. So there are times where you have to stop the immunotherapy, but a lot of patients actually tolerate that better than they tolerate the more intense chemo that's given here.
Great. Yeah. Thanks.
So this patient underwent neoadjuvant chemotherapy with TCAC and pembrolizumab. Ultrasound midway through neoadjuvant chemotherapy showed decrease in size of the mass to 0.8 centimeters. Her genetic testing was positive for a BRCA2 mutation. But just as a quick little plug for the genetic testing update that the joint ASCO SSO panel released earlier this year, the biggest thing is this just kind of adjusted some of our age guidelines. So previously we were kind of used to the 45-50. This is all patients diagnosed with breast cancer less than 65 years should receive genetic testing. Any patient over 65 years old with triple negative breast cancer who might be a candidate for PARP inhibitor therapy, who has a family history suggestive of a pathologic variant, is assigned male sex at birth, or is of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry would also be eligible for genetic testing. So this patient elected for bilateral nipple-sparing mastectomy with prepectoral implant reconstruction with a sentinel lymph node biopsy and savvy localized excision of the clip lymph node. Pathology report demonstrated 0.4 centimeters of residual tumor in the breast with 0 of 2 lymph nodes with treatment effect in 1 lymph node.
So I think one big question that is asked and has yet to be definitively answered, but we have some data for, is that question of whether the adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy is actually needed. A lot of people think that we probably are getting a lot of our benefit from the pembrolizumab that's given along with those 24 weeks of chemotherapy. And it can be hard for patients logistically, emotionally, going back to the infusion center after surgery, for so many reasons, to get that additional 9 cycles of pembrolizumab. And in KEYNOTE-522, you can see, of course, there was that 7.7% event-free survival at 36 months. Jetparnuevo, which we didn't talk about in depth because durvalumab is not yet an approved option in this situation, but was a similar study. The patients in that study got preoperative durvalumab, which is a very similar compound to pembro, but did not get any adjuvant immunotherapy. And you can see that at 3 years, the event-free survival difference between the placebo and the durva arm is still about the same, 8.4%. So that kind of, you know, it's hard to do cross-trial comparisons. You shouldn't really do them, but it does sort of raise the question of, do we need the adjuvant portion, or are we okay with just giving the neoadjuvant immunotherapy? Another question about that is looking at these patients with regard to whether they get to PCR or not. We saw the KEYNOTE data already where patients who get to PCR no matter what tend to do very, very well by 3 years. But the patients who got the pembro, that sort of differs a bit more at the 3-year time frame. And then if you look at Jepar Nuevo, you can see that at 3 years, the patients who got durvalumab but didn't get to PCR similarly did a lot better than the patients who didn't get to PCR with placebo. And that study was 69.7% versus 76%. So again, sort of raising that question of, do we really need the adjuvant portion or is the neoadjuvant portion enough? So optimized PCR is actually a study that's open at a number of places around the country, including our institution and I imagine yours potentially as well. And this is a study looking at de-escalation for those patients who get to PCR. It's hard to de-escalate in patients who don't get to PCR, but for patients who get to PCR with a minimum of 6 cycles of chemotherapy along with pembrolizumab, they can then choose to enroll in this study and be randomized to either getting pembrolizumab for an additional 9 cycles or 27 weeks, or just being observed. So I think this will be a really interesting study for those patients who are able to go on it to really show us whether or not it's an option to observe these patients after surgery who have that likelihood of a very good outcome with getting to PCR. But what about those patients who don't? So prior to KEYNOTE-522, we actually had the CREATE-X study. This was a study that was published now several years back, I think 2017, looked at patients who had both ER positive as well as triple negative breast cancer, so had to be HER2 negative, who did not get to PCR after neoadjuvant therapy and surgery. So a high-risk patient population for sure. And these patients were randomized to getting capecitabine for 8 cycles, 8 3-week cycles, so 24 weeks, or to just getting no further therapy except for endocrine therapy if they were hormone positive. And the hormone positive patients didn't seem to benefit as much from the adjuvant capecitabine, but for the patients with triple negative breast cancer, there was a benefit. You could see the disease-free survival at 5 years was 69.8% in the patients who received the CAPE versus 56.1% in patients who were on the control arm. You know, obviously a 5-year disease-free survival of 70% is still not what we want it to be. You know, that's if you're flipping a coin 10 times and it's your life, that's not what you want. So it's an important area of unmet need and somewhere where we really want to be able to do more research and be able to offer patients more in that setting. So the Olympia study was a very ambitious trial. This is, again, getting back to that point of our patient being BRCA2 positive. And this was a study that looked at olaparib, a PARP inhibitor, in those highest risk BRCA positive patients. So this is for patients who received neoadjuvant therapy for triple negative breast cancer. If they didn't get to PCR and they were BRCA positive, they were eligible to go on this study. And in the study, they would receive either placebo for a year or olaparib for a year. And again, this study was done before capecitabine was really a widespread option and certainly before adjuvant pembrolizumab. So placebo was a reasonable control arm for this trial. For hormone-positive patients who were BRCA-positive, there were a lot more sort of technicalities that needed to be met before being deemed high-risk enough to go on this trial. But I think for the purpose of this discussion, we'll talk about the triple-negative patients and go forward to talk about their outcomes. So looking at invasive disease-free survival in the whole population, you can see here that the olaparib did improve outcomes for these BRCA-positive patients, 82.7% disease-free at 4 years versus 75%. And olaparib is a pill that's taken twice a day, can cause some nausea, some hair thinning, and cytopenias, but tends to be fairly well-tolerated, and we can use dose reductions and other supportive medications to help get patients through this. So unlike some therapies we give, this actually is a pretty manageable thing to give for a year. And then if you look at the overall survival interim analysis, you can see that those curves obviously are a little bit closer together, but still numerically, it looks like you get about a 3.5% to 4% benefit if you're looking at 3- and 4-year overall survival rates. So adjuvant olaparib was also approved for these patients with high-risk early breast cancer. Patients needed to be selected for therapy based on a companion diagnostic, so we need to know for sure that they're BRCA positive, and they need to meet the criteria as indicated by the trial. So this is something that probably for the surgeons in the room, you wouldn't be making the decision and prescribing these pills. But I do think for our patients who get diagnosed with a BRCA mutation as they're going through upfront therapy, it can be a very emotional thing. And one of the things I find is actually sometimes comforting for patients is saying, hey, knowledge is power. Knowing that you have this mutation can actually allow us to treat you better. So I think that's one of the things that can potentially reassure patients if they're in your clinic and are, you know, feeling a bit let down about this new diagnosis of being a BRCA mutation carrier. I can go through this just really briefly, and then we can maybe chat a little bit before we go on to the next slide. So this is just the proposed treatment algorithm, which I think kind of highlights everything we've been talking about for the past 20 minutes or so. But basically, the patients who have early stage, either node positive or greater than 2 centimeters of triple negative disease, are most likely going to get neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. They'll then go to surgery, and then whether they get to PCR or not will really determine what you do afterwards. If they reach PCR, they're either going to do standard of care adjuvant pembrolizumab or possibly enroll in a trial looking at de-escalation of that adjuvant pembrolizumab. But if they don't get to PCR, then they would receive the adjuvant pembro most likely. If they're BRCA positive, do olaparib concurrently. Or if they're not BRCA positive, consider adjuvant capecitabine concurrently. And there haven't been studies looking specifically at these concurrent regimens in patients with early stage breast cancer. But we do have a number of studies in metastatic breast cancer, in the case of olaparib and pembro and ovarian cancer, showing that these regimens are safe and can be well tolerated together. So we do give these hand in hand. And then, of course, there are a lot of clinical trials now ongoing looking at are there better and different things we can be doing for those patients who don't get to PCR.
Great. So I guess just to go a little off the cuff, Jane,
yes.
Don't mind. Olaparib. Do you recommend patients hold olaparib if they're having surgery?
So most patients wouldn't start the olaparib until after surgery. I do typically recommend that they hold it usually for a week before and a week after, much like a lot of our other pills that can cause cytopenias. I feel like that's sometimes just the safest thing to do, and we know we're probably not going to hurt them by doing that. So I do tend to hold right around surgery if patients are going to be
I think that's another thing I think about with olaparib and these BRCA carriers. Mm-hmm. A lot of these patients are obviously choosing to have bilateral mastectomies and reconstruction.
Yes.
So a patient who's on olaparib, we may want them to finish their whole course of olaparib before we do their second stage of reconstruction or other procedures.
Yeah. No,
so
I
there may be a little
totally
delay
reasonable.
To that. And I guess on that note, not every patient potentially has a bilateral mastectomy for BRCA mutation. Alex, what are your thoughts on offering breast conservation to patients with mutations?
Yeah, so certainly I would say most of our patients elect to have the mastectomy, but I think retrospective reviews would demonstrate that the survival, there's not a huge difference for the patients that do elect to have breast conserving therapy. Certainly you might be risking a higher risk of either recurrence or new primary. Even studies that are fairly recent with modern therapies would suggest that at least the risk of a contralateral malignancy would be like 14%, I think, was the most recent study. So I think very, very select patients that are willing to continue the high-risk screening, and there's a reason that they're just not ready for that mastectomy. It could be used, but certainly, you know, the mastectomy is kind of the standard.
Great. Thanks. So with that, what we'll move on to is the early stage hormone positive HER2 negative breast cancer.
So this is a 44-year-old premenopausal patient who presents with a screen-detected left breast cancer. Diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound demonstrate a 2.2-centimeter hypoechoic mass. Biopsy demonstrates grade 3 IDC, ER99, PR15, HER2-0, with a Ki-67 of 60%. Her clinical axillary exam is normal. So she undergoes left lumpectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy, and her pathology report demonstrates a 2.4-centimeter tumor with 2 of 4 lymph nodes positive with no evidence of extranodal extension.
So Monarchy is a study that has, you know, kind of like KEYNOTE-522 did for our triple negative patients, has really revolutionized the way we treat our ER positive high risk patients. So CDK4/6 inhibitors, of which abemaciclib is one, have really transformed how we treat metastatic breast cancer. Since the first one was approved back in 2015, it's really kind of changed the natural history of that disease, at least for the first couple of years that a patient is living with it. So like any good drug that works well in the metastatic setting, we ask the question, hey, if we give this drug to more high risk early stage patients, might we prevent more patients from becoming metastatic? So this is one of the first trials to do that. And this was a trial that looked at hormone positive, HER2 negative, node positive, high risk early breast cancers. So this trial was looking at a very high risk, very specific cohort of patients. The first group, which was the most patients, looked at those who'd had either 4 or more axillary lymph nodes positive, or had between 1 and 3 axillary nodes positive and had either grade 3 disease or a tumor greater than 5 centimeters. So these are high-risk patients with a lot of cancer. And then the smaller cohort was looking at patients who had 1 to 3 axillary lymph nodes positive, so not meeting that 4 or more criteria, and then had a Ki-67 greater than or equal to 20%. But those patients could have had a grade 2 tumor or a tumor less than 5 centimeters. So basically, there was a small group of patients who got in based on high Ki-67 alone. This whole group, though, was stratified and randomized 1-to-1. Again, 5,600 patients, so very well done and large trial, to getting abemaciclib 150 milligrams twice daily for 2 years, along with their standard of care endocrine therapy, or endocrine therapy alone. And the reason this was not a placebo-controlled trial is that we know from abemaciclib and giving it in the metastatic setting that it does cause a lot of diarrhea and cytopenias. So it felt not to be really ethical to give patients a placebo and make them come in for lab checks and all these additional visits if we were really going to be able to pretty much tell by symptoms whether or not they received abemaciclib or not. So these patients were followed really for years, but followed first for invasive disease-free survival and then for a number of other key secondary endpoints. So this is looking at the five-year update from this trial, so some of the most recent data that we have. And you can see that these curves actually really do separate, and they separate longer after that two-year abemaciclib treatment period is over. So these patients are starting their endocrine therapy, starting their abemaciclib pretty much right around that time, and then they receive the abema for 2 years and continue their endocrine therapy. But you can see that when they get out 3 years beyond their cessation of abemaciclib, they're still seeing significant benefit from having received that therapy. So 7.6% absolute difference in how many patients are disease-free or not, which is very statistically as well as clinically significant endpoint for these patients. And then if you look at distant recurrence-free survival, which is a subset of that invasive disease-free survival, you can see that a lot of that benefit is actually these patients preventing distant recurrences. So 6.7% compared to that 7.6%, these were the distant recurrences that we were preventing. The problem with abemaciclib, though, in the clinic is that the adverse events can be significant. So you can see here that diarrhea is the most prominent one. Fatigue and neutropenia are probably pretty close behind. But the diarrhea and the nausea and the stomach upset are really the things that make patients, you know, stop early, come in for dose reductions, all these kinds of things. And I think one of the most important things that I tell patients and that is, you know, seen on this slide and is important is that patients on the study had these side effects. Many of them had to dose reduce. Some even had to discontinue treatment and still saw benefits. So some of our patients worry a lot about going down from 150 milligram dose to the 100 or the 50. We reassure them that, you know, if you're having side effects from the treatment, we have to dose reduce for your quality of life, and you're still likely going to receive benefit from this drug. But it is challenging. And I think, you know, for all the advances that we have, this does necessitate a lot of TLC, especially for these patients who've already been through, most of them, chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, and then the side effects from endocrine therapy, which we all know are not benign. So then what about other CDK4/6 inhibitors? There are three of them approved in the metastatic setting, and they've all now been studied up front as well. One of them, palbociclib, was studied and has not been found yet to show any benefit in the upfront setting, so it's not really an option for our early-stage patients. But the NATALEE trial recently resulted and was actually also a positive study. So this study was done a little bit differently from MONARCHY. This is using ribociclib, which is a different CDK4/6 inhibitor. And this patient population was a little bit less exclusively high-risk compared to the patient population on MONARCHY. There was a subset of node-negative patients, and that actually enrolled pretty quickly on this trial, and that sort of subset had to be closed so we could include more node-positive patients on this study. But some of these patients could be grade 2 and didn't have to have disease as large as what was seen on MONARCHY. The other big difference in this study is that patients remained on the ribociclib for 3 years as opposed to the MONARCHY, where it was only 2 years of therapy. So if you look here, you can see that what we have when we look at about 3 years of follow-up is that these patients do receive benefit from ribociclib over standard endocrine therapy, but the absolute benefit is not as strong. So about 3.1% at 3 years with ribociclib compared to the getting no ribociclib with the aromatase inhibitor. So these patients, you know, because it's a three-year time frame that they spend on study, this isn't really yet looking at data for how well do they do once you've stopped the ribociclib and continue following these folks. This is looking at distant disease-free survival, again, showing that most of that 3.1% benefit is in preventing distant recurrences, 2.7%, but still not the numbers that we saw with MONARCHY. So I think those are really some of the main differences. I think this is highlighting the differences between trials, the main one being that they used two different CDK4/6 inhibitors, the duration of therapy being different as well, 2 years versus 3 years, and then noting that the abemaciclib is given twice daily continuously, whereas the ribociclib is given kind of like a birth control pill used to be, where it's 3 weeks on and 1 week off. And the reason for that is that ribociclib causes less diarrhea but more neutropenia, and so if you give that continuously, patients often become too neutropenic. On the NATALEE trial, only anastrozole and letrozole were allowed in terms of which endocrine partners you could use, whereas in MONARCHY, it could be either of the three aromatase inhibitors or tamoxifen. And then, of course, as we've talked about, the MONARCHY population was a little bit higher risk to begin with. So in terms of our approvals, what we have approved so far in this space is abemaciclib. That's been approved since March of 2023, so we now have been using this pretty routinely in our high-risk ER-positive patients for about a year. And then the NATALEE trial has not yet seen an FDA approval, so I think it would be sort of a case-by-case situation at this point where you would start ribociclib outside of a clinical trial, but that day could be coming. So I would say that's sort of where we are at this point.
So comes up all the time in Tumor Board. You have someone who is a grade two, they've got two positive nodes, and they don't clearly meet the high-risk criteria. There's often discussion, does that person need to have an X-ray section so you know if they have four or more nodes positive?
Do you want my opinion? I can tell
I
you
love both
opinion.
Of your
Okay,
opinion.
Perfect. I'll let you go first.
I think as we continue to relax some of the criteria with the changes in the KA67 requirement and things like that, this will become less and less of a question. I think there could, in theory, be select patients that, you know, you're trying to get to that four lymph nodes so that they qualify and otherwise they don't. But I think a lot of patients, you can find another way to qualify them without the axillary dissection, or they need the axillary dissection for a different reason, just because of their other high-risk features.
And also, I think, you know, if you look at like where the FDA said this was approved, they say high risk. They don't define high risk specifically or as specifically as we had to within the trial. And I think, you know, for many of these patients, it is like a risk-benefit calculation. Not every patient that I offer abemaciclib to takes me up on that offer, because some patients do value quality of life more than they value, you know, length of life. And so it is a personal decision each time. I think if I had that patient in my clinic, rather than risk, you know, some of the challenges of axillary dissection in terms of lymphedema and healing, if there's not another compelling reason to do it and they wanted to try the abemaciclib, I would probably actually prescribe it, see how they do, and if they tolerate it well and it feels like the benefit is greater than the risk, continue it.
Oncotype play into your decision at all?
You know, I don't think it has to necessarily. I feel like, you know, with the abemaciclib, you're probably treating more of like the high risk endocrine kind of characteristics, whereas with chemo, you're really getting at those patients who are with oncotype. That's really what you're asking for. I think at this point with node positive patients, especially for premenopausal patients, we're not even often oncotyping them if they're open to chemo, because we have data showing that they benefit regardless. In older patients, I think if I had an oncotype that were high, I would be more likely to recommend this, just because that sort of signals to me this is an angrier tumor that is probably going to benefit from more therapy across the board. But it wouldn't necessarily, if it were low and the patient were, you know, optimistic about the opportunity of trying it, I wouldn't withhold.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I guess another question that comes up with our plastic surgery colleagues too, much as we were talking about some of the considerations around a laparib and reconstruction, for a patient who's on abemaciclib who is planned for some breast reconstructive surgery, how do you need to manage the medication for that patient?
Similarly, you know, especially with this drug, because it causes, you know, can cause some diarrhea and dehydration and can cause neutropenia, I usually do recommend that 1 week before and 1 week after. We know that these patients, even more than a laparib patients, will, their white counts bounce back pretty quickly. So even if they are sort of chronically a bit neutropenic with the drug, if you hold it for a week, they'll come right back to normal.
Great. Thank you. And I'm peppering you with questions here,
okay.
But I have one more. If we think about what's coming down the pike for immunotherapy in hormone receptor positive breast cancer, is there anything coming and for which patients?
Yeah, so there are some interesting studies that are looking at immunotherapy for patients with high-risk hormone-positive early-stage breast cancer. And actually, the same study that I referenced that looked at first just Taxol and pembrolizumab plus AC looked at that in ER-positive as well as triple-negative patients and saw benefit, and that was years ago, for the ER-positive patients as well. So those patients have now been studied in other studies, including KEYNOTE-756, which reported out earlier this year for the first time. And so I think that it is definitely the case that that may be coming. It's not here yet. And I think one of the challenges we have in breast cancer in general is that so many of our studies change the standard of care, but then others come along and change it again, and we don't necessarily have the data after that to then incorporate the old things. So once we have potentially immunotherapy as an option, it'll be hard to know how much more does abemaciclib benefit patients who've received neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy. So there's still, I think, is a lot of room for the art of medicine in those decisions. Yeah.
All right. So lastly, we were going to talk about early stage HER2-positive breast cancer.
So this is a 54-year-old female patient who's called back from screening for an asymmetry in the left breast. Diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound demonstrate a 2.5-centimeter mass in the breast, and there is concern for one enlarged ipsilateral axillary lymph node with a thickened cortex. Biopsy demonstrates IDC, ER95, PR93, HER2-2+ with positive FISH. Biopsy of an ipsilateral axillary lymph node is also positive.
So I think, you know, the answer here, if you were taking the medical oncology boards today, which hopefully no one did, TCHP would be the current standard of care for these patients, either TCHP or THP plus AC. But you know, there are questions about this too. Now with multi-agent anti-HER2 therapy, do we need as much chemo for these patients? You know, generally, we wouldn't take these patients directly to surgery because if they're node positive, they're high risk enough to warrant upfront therapy. And immunotherapy is not yet something that's used as part of the standard of care for HER2 positive. So THP would be the standard answer here. But a lot of us are thinking that it's possible neoadjuvant THP, so minus the carboplatin, could become a new standard of care for a subset of patients. So the COMPASS trial is a trial, I think, a great one, and it was designed a long time ago, and now I think is almost fully enrolled, if not completely enrolled. And this is a study that's looking at surgery as a way to sort of stratify people for whether they need more or whether they need less treatment. So this looked at patients with stage 2 or 3A HER2-positive breast cancer. So important because these patients had to have tumors greater than 2 centimeters. They could be node negative, but this study excluded those patients with the most aggressive disease. So stage 3B, stage 3C were not eligible for this, you know, what was essentially a de-escalation study. ER-positive and ER-negative patients were eligible as long as they were HER2-positive. Patients then received THP times 4 cycles. So TCHP is typically, you know, 2 chemotherapy drugs and 2 anti-HER2 drugs given for 6 cycles. This is looking at shortening that regimen and removing 1 chemotherapy agent. So as you can imagine, a much better tolerated regimen. Patients then, you know, received their 12 weeks of treatment. They went to surgery. And if they got to PCR with that regimen, which a lot of our patients do, especially those who are more strongly HER2 positive, then in this trial, they complete 1 year of adjuvant trastuzumab and pertuzumab, along with endocrine therapy if they are candidates for endocrine therapy. And if they don't get to PCR, then they receive additional potentially standard of care treatment or can enroll in other studies. So this study, you know, we have not reported out what this study shows yet, but if this study shows a benefit, particularly those patients who, you know, get to PCR if they do well, this could become a new standard of care to start with, then with additional treatment to be given later on if PCR is not achieved. DeCrescendo is another study looking at something very similar. So this is HER2-positive hormone receptor-negative breast cancer. These patients can have tumors 1.5 centimeters greater, so a little bit smaller tumors are included, and node-negative. And these patients get a very similar regimen where they're getting trastuzumab and pertuzumab plus paclitaxel, 4 cycles, then going to surgery, and if they get to PCR, just continuing the dual-agent anti-HER2 therapy. And then if they have residual disease after surgery, they're then further stratified by how much residual disease they have to determine what treatment they should get next. And I won't go into too many of the specifics of that just in the interest of time, but if people have questions about that, I'm happy to take those after.
So this patient completes 6 cycles of TCHP. Following the first cycle, her breast mass and axillary lymph node are no longer palpable. She has a complete clinical response by the time she's ready for surgery. So what is your surgical approach to the axilla for this patient? Just a brief discussion on clipping or not clipping lymph nodes. So we know from Z1071 and Centina trials that using dual tracer and obtaining greater than 3 lymph nodes resulted in an appropriate false negative rate for sentinel lymph node biopsies following neoadjuvant chemotherapy. There's also places that just clip the nodes, and that results in a false negative rate of 2 to 4% if you retrieve that clipped lymph node. This certainly remains a topic of discussion and examination. I think every conference there's a little bit of this discussion. I don't think that there's necessarily a right or wrong answer. In training, we never clipped nodes. We always went for the 3. In my practice, we do clip the lymph nodes. I do think it's a nice thing. I think anecdotally, the patients like it. They like the idea of the lymph node that was positive coming out later on, just to make sure that there's not still cancer there. I do think it's also a kind of an extra fail-safe to avoid that axillary dissection. I think there's been recent data that would suggest that if you get those greater than 3 lymph nodes and don't obtain the clip with the sentinel lymph node biopsy, that you don't necessarily have to do the axillary dissection. So it's kind of a nice extra backup. You can either get the clip or get the 3 lymph nodes. And I think that's nice in the patients that have a neoadjuvant and don't necessarily always map. So this patient undergoes bilateral mastectomy with immediate reconstruction with sentinel lymph node biopsy and targeted node biopsy. Her surgical pathology demonstrates a 0.5 centimeter residual tumor with 0 of 3 sentinel lymph nodes involved. What adjuvant systemic therapy should this patient receive?
So we're not even going to make you answer that question because it's too complicated. but I'm going to tell you what some of the options are. So we know that kind of like triple negative breast cancer, HER2 positive breast cancer, especially those patients who are hormone negative and HER2 positive, PCR rate can be a predictor of what's to come. So if you get to PCR, you can feel very reassured. The patients are likely to do well and give them adjuvant trastuzumab or trastuzumab and pertuzumab. But if they don't get to PCR with that neoadjuvant chemotherapy, you feel a little uneasy about it. So much like with triple negative breast cancer, we've done some studies now to look at those patients who have residual disease to better determine what should those patients do after. So Catherine was one of the most pivotal of those studies to date. Another very ambitious trial. This trial looked at patients who received neoadjuvant HER2-directed therapy for a HER2-positive cancer. They could have been hormone-positive or hormone-negative. Had to have had at least 9 weeks of a taxane, had to receive all their chemotherapy prior to surgery, and then had to go to surgery and have residual invasive cancer in their breast or axillary nodes, and then sign up for this trial and get randomized. So patients were randomized in this study before adjuvant pertuzumab was an option. So they were randomized to receive either T-DM1, which is an antibody-drug conjugate that at the time was the standard of care, second-line treatment in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, or to receive trastuzumab. So you're noticing a pattern here. These drugs that are helpful in the metastatic setting then get studied earlier on in our highest-risk patients. So that was what this study looked at. And then you can see that there are a number of stratification factors, and we'll take a look at all those different categories and see how these patients did. So the overall outcome of this trial was actually pretty astounding. You don't always see curves separate this much. This is looking at 3-year invasive disease-free survival. And much like with triple-negative breast cancer, a lot of HER2-positive patients, if they're going to recur, tend to recur by this 3-year time point. So this was very clinically useful information. What you see is that the 3-year invasive disease-free survival was improved by 11%. For patients who receive T-DM1 instead of trastuzumab. And if you look at what percentage of those are distant recurrences versus local recurrences, you can see that we really are preventing a lot of distant recurrences here. So again, very statistically meaningful, hazard ratio of 0.5, and quite clinically meaningful as well. So that really pretty quickly became a standard of care for patients who have residual disease. And then neratinib was another drug that was studied in another trial, Extinet, which resulted right around the same time. So this trial was designed very differently. Neratinib is an EGFR inhibitor, and it's a pill. 240 milligrams once a day is the starting dose. And what this did was looked at extended adjuvant therapy. So patients who'd received trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting, had not gotten pertuzumab, had not gotten T-DM1, were then randomized after they finished their year of adjuvant trastuzumab to receive a placebo for a year or to receive neratinib for a year. So neratinib, kind of like some of the other drugs we've talked about, actually does cause a lot of diarrhea, arguably more diarrhea even than abemaciclib. So this can be a tough drug to take, and the patients are often fatigued after, you know, a year and more of multidisciplinary therapy with surgery, radiation, and all the chemo we've discussed. But this is one of those options that, you know, for patients who are highly motivated, they could enroll in this trial and extend their treatment more. So you can see that at 5 years, there was actually a benefit, albeit a small one in the neratinib group, 90.2% invasive disease-free survival versus 87.7% for placebo. This trial enrolled a slightly less high-risk group than the Catherine's trial did, which is why the placebo group also did so well. So about a 2.5% benefit in invasive disease-free survival at 5 years, and really not any difference in the overall survival. If you look at hormone-positive versus hormone-negative patients on this trial, you can see that the benefit was largely driven, we think, by the hormone-positive patients. This probably has to do with some of the interplay between neratinib and endocrine therapy. So by blocking HER2 to some degree and using endocrine therapy as well, which all these ER-positive patients did, you may get some additional protection for longer. So those are sort of the two options that we have right now as standard of care for those patients who have residual disease. I think many people are using T-DM1 as sort of the standard, and adding on Extinet only for those highest motivated hormone-positive, HER2-positive patients with residual disease. And then what's coming down the pike? So we talked about the COMPASS trial already. So COMPASS HER2-RD is the COMPASS trial sort of continued for those who have residual disease after their 4 cycles of THP. And these patients can go on to then be randomized to either receiving T-DM1 itself, which was the drug studied on the Catherine trial that led to that 11% benefit, or to T-DM1 plus tucatinib. Tucatinib is another pill that inhibits EGFR, but does so a little bit more in a targeted way. So it causes less diarrhea generally than neratinib does. It's kind of the idea of, can we add something to T-DM1 to make those patients with residual disease do even better than they currently do with modern regimens? And the Astefania trial is another one, again, looking at that question of, can we add more? This is where the immunotherapy potentially comes in for those of you who are interested in immunotherapy for this patient population. So these are patients also with residual invasive disease in the breast or axillary nodes, can be ER positive or ER negative, but have to be HER2 positive. And then they get randomized to receive either T-DM1, the new standard of care after the Catherine trial, or T-DM1 plus atezolizumab, which is another immunotherapy drug. And then Destiny Breast 05, finally, is another study that's looking at, you know, can we improve on T-DM1 altogether rather than adding something to it? Can we simply replace it? So T-DXd, or trastuzumab deruxtecan, is another antibody drug conjugate that has outperformed T-DM1 in the metastatic space. And so Destiny Breast 05 will show us, can this drug actually outperform T-DM1 in the post neoadjuvant residual disease space as well. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing these results and seeing how many of these trials could potentially change our standards of care, at least our opportunities for patients.
Great. So just a little more discussion for us surgeons thinking about some of the approaches after a patient's received neoadjuvant therapy. As you alluded to, I think it's, you know, COMPASS is a great trial and it's still enrolling. And I think a lot of people are very much in favor of trying to de-escalate that therapy, as you mentioned, since you know you can sort of re-escalate afterwards if need be. Alex, if you have a patient who has received THP and you're trying to decide, you know, maybe a node positive patient, and you're trying to decide if they are ready to go to surgery or if you're really going to try to push some additional, you know, neoadjuvant systemic therapy before that surgery, anything you do differently in terms of imaging to check that out?
Not necessarily. You know, we always try to match sort of whatever we were basing the pre-neochemo decisions on. So, you know, if it was measured in a way on MRI that was different from ultrasound, you know, maybe we repeat the MRI, but we generally try to do the ultrasound. Primarily in our office, we have in-office ultrasound, so it's super easy for us to pop it on there and just make sure that they're having a good response. So, you know, that is certainly our default if it's available. But, you know, we want to make sure that we are having that appropriate response during the therapy.
Great. Yeah, and I think, you know, we're at my institution, we do not necessarily get MRIs on everyone, but I think particularly in this patient population, if we're considering sort of a more of a de-escalated approach, that might be a patient where we would get that MRI because that may be another way to kind of look for residual disease before we're deciding to go to surgery. And I know that's written into some of the trials, in fact, to look that way. And so I guess, Jane, if we gave THP and then or TCHP and found someone had, or yeah, I guess THP, yeah. TCHP, they're all done, and found that somebody seemed to have residual disease, what would you do from there on before surgery?
So I think this is where, again, the art of medicine totally comes into play and shared decision-making with the patient is really important. But I think, you know, HER2 positivity can sort of be on a little bit of a continuum. We have some studies showing those patients who are 3+ on IHC tend to respond best to those, you know, HER2-directed, strongly HER2-directed therapies, whereas those patients who are technically positive but may have, you know, lower actual HER2 expression on FISH or lower HER2-17 ratios may not respond as robustly or be as likely to get to PCR. We've actually had institutional data showing that like the highest predictor of complete response to neoadjuvant TCHP is actually whether you're HER2 IHC 3+ or whether you're 2+ and FISH positive. So right away, I can kind of have some predictors in my head when I see a patient and start them on THP or TCHP of how well they're likely to do with this. And then I think for those patients who are, you know, strongly HER2 positive and maybe don't get to a complete response based on imaging or physical exam with TCHP or THP times 4, say, then I might encourage them potentially to add carboplatin and continue the THP because some of them, if they're having a partial response, maybe they just need a little more treatment like what was done in the TCHP trials. But in patients who are sort of just over that threshold for HER2 positivity, but I suspect may have a little bit of a triple negative subclone potentially there, those are the patients where I might actually say, hey, you've had your 4 cycles of THP, we'll see how this goes, but now I'd like to switch you to AC and actually do 4 of AC before surgery to see if I can get at that other piece of it. And then after those things are done, I would then typically probably go to surgery and then probably pursue a residual disease regimen depending on what happens next.
And so that concludes our portion of the presentation. So if you do have any questions, please do submit them through the QR code. I do have some questions here. So maybe I'll start us off with those and I'll keep monitoring as we talk. So Jane, a question for you. I know we talked about germline BRCA mutations being candidates for PARP inhibitors. Mm-hmm. A question came through asking if someone has a somatic BRCA mutation, would you consider a PARP inhibitor for that patient?
It's a really interesting question. So a lot of times we get that information in the metastatic setting where we're sequencing the tumor or sending blood-based circulating tumor DNA testing. There are studies showing, good studies in the metastatic space, that you can actually use olaparib and other PARP inhibitors for patients who have somatic mutations. It's hard because in the early stage setting, we typically aren't really testing for somatic BRCA mutations because we wouldn't be sequencing the whole tumor in a curative patient. So I can't think of a situation where that would come up. I think technically it's not approved that way, so it would be sort of a shared decision if I were faced with that data.
And then another one that's just kind of come through in a couple different ways. There's obviously a lot of interest, and there's been a lot of talk about liquid biopsies and circulating tumor DNA. Mm-hmm. So I guess if you could speak to, is that something that you're routinely looking at right now? Like, what's its role? And I guess, does it help you decide if someone's high risk, like that you're going to add a BEMA if you might not?
So definitely not something I'm looking at in a standard of care way now. I think we have to be really careful with this technology. So what you can do is you can look and see circulating tumor DNA in the bloodstream, and whether you have that or not, you know, it's a little bit hard to know what to do with that or how to use that information. It's being studied in several different ways. There are trials right now, like the DARE trial, which is looking at patients with stage 2 or stage 3 ER-positive breast cancer after they finish their surgery, chemotherapy, et cetera, and are on endocrine therapy. What that's doing is it's checking ctDNA every 6 months in those patients. And then if ctDNA is found to be positive, you then have the ability to randomize those patients, if they choose to be randomized, to receiving sort of a stepped-up version of endocrine therapy versus staying on the same treatment. And the reason it's being studied in that way is because we know that these tests can cause a lot of anxiety, and also, of course, cost to the healthcare system and things like that. What we don't know is if we find ctDNA in someone who we've previously thought we've cured, do we actually improve how long they survive or how well they feel by escalating treatment sooner? So trials like DARE will answer, I think, both of those questions, but it's not something that I'm checking routinely in early stage patients. There are some really interesting sort of research-based only papers looking at checking circulating tumor DNA in patients undergoing neoadjuvant chemotherapy and showing that if you start with circulating tumor DNA present but end neoadjuvant chemotherapy with ctDNA absent, your chance of doing well regardless of whether you get to PCR is actually very, very good. So I think that data is really interesting and may inform standards down the line, but it's not something I would routinely order or have routinely ordered for my curative patients outside of a clinical trial.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Alex, one for you. So if we think about these patients who are now getting IO, like the R triple negative patients receiving Pembro before surgery, what is your thought about, is there a risk of longer time to surgery after completion of therapy? Should those patients be holding the Pembro around the time of surgery? And any thoughts on increased risk for complications in that setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Keynote regimen is just really rough. So I've definitely had some patients that, you know, have been dehydrated and needed extra time. But I think we get them there eventually. I think the adrenal sufficiency is definitely the one and that we always are, you know, just have to be very aware of before surgery. But, you know, I think the timing, it's based on the patient, but definitely something we watch for.
Great. And everyone is asking a lot of questions about immunotherapy. So one that came up is for a patient, and it's a very specific question, but I'll make it a little more generalized. For a patient where they may have a complication that is potentially attributable to pembrolizumab, in the example given here is someone who presents with a new diagnosis of diabetes. Would that be something you'd expect to see or potentially see with pembrolizumab? And would you potentially discontinue that treatment with a side effect where you weren't sure?
You know, not necessarily. So one of the things, some of the things that are the most common are hypothyroidism and sometimes diabetes is another one that we see. And in patients who are high risk enough to warrant this treatment, we often will actually partner with endocrinology to manage both of those things, either the diabetes or the hypothyroidism, so that the patients can continue on chemotherapy. The things that we stop it for tend to be more things like adrenal insufficiency, which can sometimes be harder to manage and sometimes even more life-threatening. The liver stuff, because it's sometimes hard to know if like hepatitis or pneumonitis will resolve as well as we want it to if you continue the immunotherapy. But some of those most common endocrinopathies we will often treat through. And try to hedge our bets. I think it also depends, you know, how old is the patient? What are their other comorbidities? Is this a 2.2 centimeter node negative cancer? Or is this someone who has bulky nodal disease? Risk versus benefit certainly comes into play, but diabetes for me would not be a like total kill the regimen kind of complication.
Great. And then just to go back to our hormone positive patients, there's just, I know you alluded to potentially not checking Oncotype in a node positive premenopausal patient, but when are you using Oncotype DX for a node positive patient?
So I think where I use it is two places. One, definitely for postmenopausal women, because a lot of these women we know, thanks to TailorX, can now actually withhold chemotherapy safely if their Oncotype is below 25. And so for a lot of women, that's a very, you know, advantageous option. And then there's some premenopausal women, you know, and there's, I think a lot of us are on the fence about, you know, for those patients who have lower oncotype, but are premenopausal and node positive, is it really the chemotherapy that's leading to benefit, or is it the ovarian suppression caused by the chemotherapy? And there's studies being designed and implemented to look at that question, you know, actually randomizing these node positive premenopausal women to chemo versus ovarian suppression and endocrine therapy. But until we have those answers, it's a little bit of anybody's guess. And one of the things that we saw in Taylor X was that the benefit for chemotherapy was actually a little bit more pronounced in patients who had oncotypes between like 14 and 25 compared to 0 and 13. So if patients are premenopausal and, you know, have lower grade disease and are on the fence about chemo or have other comorbidities, those might be patients where I might check oncotype so I can talk to patients about, you know, the absolute gradation of benefit they're likely to receive versus not. And there are patients who sometimes will share the decision to withhold the chemo and do endocrine therapy along with ovarian suppression.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, it looks like we're at time here. So we'd like to thank all of you who joined us both in person and virtually tonight. This was a great discussion. So thank you to my co-speakers as well.
Of course. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/YGX860. This activity is supported by independent educational grants from AstraZeneca and Merck & Company Incorporated.